Okay, so you know how sometimes you just need like a super focused breakdown of something, like you've got all these different sources, maybe some notes, an analysis, a standard brief, and you need to like pull out the core ideas? Well, that's kind of what we're doing today. We're going deep on a legal case that's pretty huge, especially for anyone out there wrestling with the always exciting world of warranty law.
Yeah, warranty law, always a crowd pleaser.
You sent over some really interesting stuff on this case.
Yeah.
Goddard v. General Motors Corp., right? Decided by the Ohio Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And it seems like all these sources are kind of circling this idea of limited remedies and like what happens when they just totally don't cut it. So our mission, should we choose to accept it, is to basically figure out what are the big warranty law takeaways from Goddard and what does it tell us about how these limited remedies actually work or don't work in practice?
I think that's a great way to frame it. You know, Goddard v. General Motors Corp., that name might just seem like, oh, another case to memorize for the exam, but it's actually a landmark case in warranty law, and it boils down to a pretty straightforward rule.
Okay, hit me with it.
Basically, it says that if a warranty limits your remedy for a problem, like let's say it only covers repair or replacement, but that limited remedy just doesn't work, like it fails to actually solve the
It's
problem.
like putting a band-aid on a broken arm.
Exactly. Then you might be able to recover more than just the cost of the repair or replacement. You might be able to go after what are called consequential damages.
Okay, before we get too deep into the legal weeds here, can you kind of set the stage for us? What were the facts of the Goddard case? Like, what actually happened that led to this big legal showdown?
All right, so picture this. It's 1973. Our appellant, that's the person who filed the lawsuit, buys a shiny new Chevrolet Vega from, you guessed it, General Motors.
A Vega,
That's
it's a
what I like to say
classic.
it. Well, not exactly known for its reliability, right? And this particular Vega, let's just say, was living up to that reputation. It was a bit of a lemon, shall we say.
A lemon. Okay, I'm seeing where this is going.
Now, here's the catch. The express warranty that came with the car was, well, limited. It said that GM would only repair or replace any defective parts for the first 12 months or 12,000 miles, whichever came first.
Okay, pretty standard warranty stuff, right?
Yeah, pretty typical. But, and this is a big of but, the warranty also very clearly said that GM wouldn't be on the hook for any consequential damages.
Ah, there it is. Consequential damages. I feel like this is going to be important. Remind us again what that means.
Right, so consequential damages are basically any losses that you suffer as a consequence of the product being defective. So, like, if your car keeps breaking down and you miss work because of it, you might lose wages. Those lost wages could be considered consequential damages.
So it's like the ripple effect of the problem, not just the problem itself.
Precisely. And it makes sense why a company like GM would want to try and limit their liability there. It could get really expensive.
So, okay, back to our lemon-owning appellant. What was their main beef with this Vega?
They were basically arguing that this car was so messed up, so riddled with defects, as they put it, that simply repairing or replacing parts wasn't going to fix the core problem. They were saying the car was basically a lemon and that the limited remedy offered in the warranty just failed to do what it was supposed to do.
So, what happened when they took GM to court? Did the lower courts buy this whole failure of essential purpose argument?
Nope, not initially. The lower courts actually sided with General Motors. They said the buyer was stuck with the limited warranty because, hey, they agreed to it when they bought the car.
So, case closed.
Not so fast. That's where the Ohio Supreme Court steps in and says, hold on a minute. They actually reversed the lower court's decision. And that's what makes this case so important.
All right, now things are getting interesting. So, what were the big legal issues the Ohio Supreme Court had to sort out? What was the crux of the matter here?
Well, the big conflict was about how two parts of the Uniform Commercial Code, or UCC, work together specifically, as they're laid out in Ohio's Revised Code, Section 1302.93, which is pretty much identical to UCC Section 2719.
Okay, getting into the nitty-gritty of the UCC, I'm following.
So, subsection A of this law, it basically says that sellers are allowed to limit or modify remedies. So they can say, hey, the only thing you get if something's wrong is repair or replacement. This ties into the whole freedom of contract thing, the idea that parties should be able to agree on whatever terms they want.
Right, makes sense. So, what's the other side of that coin? You mentioned there were two parts at play here.
Yeah, so then you have subsection B, which brings in this idea of failure of essential purpose. It basically says that if a limited remedy, like repair or replacement, just doesn't work, it fails to achieve its essential purpose, then other remedies that are normally available under the UCC kick in. And this is where things get a little tricky.
I can see how that would create a bit of a tug of war, legally speaking.
Right. You have this tension between freedom of contract, letting businesses manage their risk, and the need to protect consumers. You don't want buyers to be left high and dry if a product's a dud and the promised fix is useless.
So the court had to walk a fine line. How did they figure out when a limited remedy goes too far and the buyer deserves more than just endless repair attempts?
Well, they lean pretty heavily on that second part of the UCC provision, the Ohio Revised Code 1302.93B, the failure of essential purpose part. They said, sure, subsection A lets sellers limit remedies, but only if that limited remedy actually does what it's supposed to do. The majority opinion really zeroed in on this idea of fairness. They were basically like, look, GM couldn't fix this Vega. All those repair attempts, they were meaningless to the buyer. The car was still a lemon.
So common sense prevailed.
You could say that. And there's this great line from Justice Herber in the majority opinion. He says, repudiation of warranty obligations destroys its benefits and limitations.
Oh, that's pretty powerful. Break that down for us.
Basically, the court is saying a seller can't just pick and choose which parts of the warranty they want to uphold. They can't be like, okay, we're not going to fix your car properly, but T, we're still going to hide behind the part of the warranty that says we don't have to pay you consequential
Oh
damages.
no, having your cake and eating it too, huh?
Nope. The court said if you're not going to hold up your end of the bargain, which in this case was effectively repairing the car, you can't expect to benefit from the limitations that were part of that same bargain.
It really gets at the heart of what a warranty is supposed to be, right? It's supposed to provide some assurance that the product will actually work. The UCC isn't designed to give sellers a free pass to offer shoddy products and then hide behind legal loopholes.
Exactly. The UCC is all about fairness in the marketplace, and that means making sure remedies actually remedy the situation. Goddard really highlights that tension in contract law, wanting to give parties freedom to make their own agreements, but also recognizing that sometimes those agreements can be totally unfair, especially when one party has way more power than the other. And in this case, the court sided with fairness, with making sure those limitations didn't let GM completely off the hook for a car they couldn't fix.
Okay, so we've established the court thought this limited remedy failed its essential purpose. How did they come to that conclusion? Was there some kind of test they used, something other courts can follow in the future?
There is. They basically laid out this three-part test to figure out when a limited remedy fails. First, they ask, did the seller actually try to repair or replace the defective part within a reasonable amount of time? And did they do it in a way that made sense? Like, did they put in the effort?
Makes sense. What's the second part?
Second, did the defect really screw up the value of what the buyer paid for? Like, was it a big enough problem to make the product basically unusable?
So not just a cosmetic issue, something that really impacts functionality.
Right. And then third, did all the defects together, not just one isolated thing, really mess up the value of the goods for the buyer? This last part was super important in the Vega case because it wasn't just one little thing wrong. It was like a never-ending parade of problems that made the car totally unreliable. The court saw that pattern of failed repairs and said, okay, enough is enough. This remedy clearly isn't cutting it.
It's like death by a thousand paper cuts. Each individual problem might not seem huge, but the cumulative effect is debilitating. So the court was saying, hey, you can't keep giving the buyer paper cuts and call it a day.
Exactly. You buy a new car, you expect it to be, well, a car, not a constant source of frustration.
So for all our law students out there listening, why should they care about Goddard? What are the big takeaways for their future legal careers?
I'd say there are a couple of really important things to take away from this. First, it shows that consumers actually have some power. Those limitations you see in warranties, they're not bulletproof. If a company can't or won't fix a messed up product, a buyer can take them to court and say, hey, this limited remedy isn't enough. I deserve more than that. They might even be able to recover those consequential damages we talked about, even if the warranty says they can't.
So it's a win for the little guy, the consumer.
Yeah.
What about the flip side?
Well, on the flip side, Goddard is like a big warning sign for sellers. It's saying you can't just slap super restrictive warranties on your products and then shirk your responsibility to actually make things right.
You can't just write your way out of accountability.
Right. If companies do that, they risk those limitations being thrown out, and that could leave them on the hook for a lot more money.
Makes sense.
And, This case comes up all the time in what we call lemon law cases, those disputes where people have issues with new cars. Thinking about how this ties into your law school classes, it's sort of like the concept of unconscionability in contracts.
Yeah, where a contract is so one-sided, it's basically unenforceable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The failure of essential purpose doctrine works kind of like that. It prevents those unfair contract terms from being used against the buyer.
Okay, so we're really starting to see how Goddard has these real-world practical implications. Are there any other nuances or distinctions we should keep in mind when we're talking about this case and this whole failure of essential purpose thing?
Oh, absolutely. There are some important things to remember. First off, it's super important to understand the difference between consequential damages, which we've been talking about, and direct damages.
Right, got to keep those straight.
Direct damages are the losses that are like immediately caused by the breach of warranty. Like if the buyer had to pay for the repair themselves, that would be a direct damage. Consequential damages are those indirect losses, like the lost wages example. And warranties often try to specifically exclude consequential damages. But as Goddard shows, that might not always fly if the limited remedy of repair or replacement is a bust.
So it's not just about getting the product fixed, it's about getting compensated for the broader consequences of the defect.
Exactly. And another thing to remember is how different parts of the UCC fit together. Section 279A, it generally says that you can limit or exclude remedies, but then 2792, the failure of essential purpose section, it's like a check on that power. When a limited remedy is found to have failed its essential purpose, like in Goddard, then it basically overrides the general rule that says you can limit remedies.
So it's like a hierarchy within the law itself.
Exactly. The law is basically saying, look, we want to make sure people have some way to get a real remedy, even if the contract says otherwise.
It's not just about following the letter of the law. It's about ensuring a fair outcome.
Absolutely. And one final thing. When we're talking about essential purpose, it's not just about whether the seller technically tried to fix things. It's about whether those attempts actually worked. Like, did they actually get the product into the shape it was supposed to be in within a reasonable time? If a seller keeps making half-hearted attempts at repairs that don't actually solve the problem, that could be enough for a court to say, nope, this remedy has failed its essential purpose, even if the seller technically followed the steps outlined in the warranty.
So it's not just about going through the motions. It's about achieving the intended result.
Exactly. It's about good faith effort and actually fixing the problem.
Okay, so wrapping up our deep dive into Goddard v. General Motors, what's the bottom line for our listeners who are, you know, about to embark on their legal careers?
I think the big takeaway here is that UCC Section 2719, it doesn't give sellers carte blanche to limit remedies however they want. Those limitations only hold up if the remedies they offer actually work. The Ohio Supreme Court made it crystal clear that if a promised remedy, like repair or replacement, doesn't actually address the problem, the courts are going to side with fairness. They're going to say that the spirit of the warranty, the underlying idea that the product should actually work, is more important than any super restrictive language the seller might have snuck into the contract. And that could mean buyers are able to recover consequential damages, even if the warranty says they can't.
It's a great reminder that sometimes the law has to step in and make sure things are fair, even if a contract seems to say otherwise.
It really makes you think about the responsibilities that come with making a promise, doesn't it? Like, it's not enough to just say you'll do something. You actually have to follow through, especially when it comes to something as important as a warranty.
Absolutely. Now, here's a final thought for you to ponder as you continue your legal journey. Should this failure of essential purpose idea apply differently in different situations? Like, what about when it's a deal between two big companies who both have lawyers and know all the ins and outs of contracts? Should it be treated the same as when it's a consumer buying something from a huge corporation where they might not have as much bargaining power?
That's a great question.
It's something to keep in mind as you continue to learn about contract law and warranty law and all the fascinating ways they play out in the real world.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it.
Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.